Chuck Kunert. If you've been to some of my sessions before, you know that already. And my area is genetic engineering. I'll make a confession, and that is that right now I'd rather be next door. You're hearing what Annie Powell has to say about gay and lesbian theology, because it ties directly into the topic we covered yesterday, which was the biology of homosexuality. But be that as it may, we're going to be talking about some exciting new frontiers that are opening up in the area of therapies for disease based on genetic engineering. And the spectrum of diseases that we're going to be talking about is immense. So before we even begin, I'm talking about the therapies. I'd like to talk a little bit about what is disease and kind of give us a general perspective so we know why science is going the direction it's going and why genetic engineering is such a powerful tool. Basically, diseases fall into one of several categories. In America today, well, let's back up a little bit. 100 years ago, if you were to go to a Midwestern church, particularly a Lutheran church, you would find that many of those churches had adjacent to them a cemetery. And at least in the Missouri Synod tradition, and I'm not sure about the ALC and LCA tradition, but in the Missouri Synod tradition, cemeteries were segregated. There were male halves and female halves, and a third section, the children. And in many cases, that's the way they buried their people. What you would have found 100 years ago is that the section that contained children was huge. The reason for that was most deaths 100 years ago were due to infectious diseases, and particularly to childhood diseases. Things like diphtheria, whooping cough, tetanus, measles, mumps, smallpox, things that the children were particularly susceptible to. Now, of course, there has been a dramatic shift. And infectious diseases are no longer the major cause of death in the United States. What causes death in the United States right now in most of the developed world, first world countries, are degenerative diseases, cardiovascular disease, disease of the heart, and diseases that are environmentally caused or stimulated, like cancer. And, of course, accidental death or murder, which is not exactly accidental death, but it's not a disease. Well, it's we won't go into that. That's a different topic, a different session. We might do that next week. Okay, so we have degenerative diseases. We have infectious diseases. We have cell growth diseases like cancer, which is really just cells going wacko and dividing when they shouldn't be dividing. We have metabolic disorder diseases, where your body cannot process things normally. For example, one of the things that's typically tested for when a newborn is arrives in a hospital is PKU, phenylketonuria. And phenylketonuria is a metabolic disorder. That is, the baby cannot use the amino acid phenylalanine properly. As a result, they build up toxic byproducts in their body, and it can cause damage to their nervous system, and eventually it can in fact cause death. And another type of disease is neurological diseases, diseases of the nervous system, schizophrenia, manic depression, those kinds of diseases. And I'm differentiating that from diseases that are degenerative diseases, because they're slightly different. And there are other diseases as well. But the bottom line, if you take a look at all the diseases that affect human beings, What we find is that if we can isolate and narrow down and study long enough, we can identify that all diseases have, at their bottom line, a molecular basis. That is, it's not hocus pocus. There are actually structures inside the living body that are not working right. And these structures are the molecules that make up the living cells, which in turn make up the living body. Therefore, the powerful tool that we have been granted, I think, by God today, is the tool of genetic engineering, which attempts to utilize that information, the information about the actual way in which atoms and molecules are put together, to solve the diseases of mankind. Now, there are a lot of diseases, and so there's a lot of work to do. But a lot of progress is being made, an exciting amount of progress in the past decade. And I want to talk a little bit about approaches to conquering disease utilizing genetic engineering. One of the first things genetic engineering can be used for is the identification of the defect itself. What's wrong at the molecular level? Okay. Why is it, for example, that people in certain cultures and some Americans have a difficult time breathing and have a difficult time doing any strenuous exercise? If we examine, and we've been doing this for probably 100 years, if we examine their blood, we can see that their blood cells are oddly shaped in these cases. In fact, they look like little sickles, and so the disease is called sickle cell anemia. Now, we've known that for probably six decades. In the 1950s, it became apparent that the blood cell that carries oxygen through your body is composed of special proteins. The proteins called globin. And they go together with iron to make a substance called hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is actually the thing that carries the oxygen in your blood. So it was long suspected that people with sickle cell anemia probably had some problem with their globin proteins. But we didn't know what that problem was or the nature of it until genetic engineering allowed us to analyze it at the molecular level in the mid-70s. And beginning in the mid-70s, an intensive study was made of the nature of this defect. And it was found that globin, which is a protein molecule that's made up of 146 amino acids, which are the building blocks of the proteins. That's why you have to have amino acids in your diet. You have to build proteins out of them. The globin molecule is made of 146 amino acids. And in those people with sickle cell anemia, one of those 146 amino acids is wrong, in there mistakenly. And what's more, the DNA that codes for that protein simply has one of its letters, one of its bases changed, so that it results in a faulty code for the amino acid. So we now understand that the defect, sickle cell anemia, is caused by a single mutation in DNA at a specific spot in the gene for globin. Now, that unfortunately doesn't necessarily mean we can cure sickle cell anemia, but it does give us a step up on it. Similarly, work that's been recently completed, or not completed, but is still in progress, has identified that Alzheimer's disease in certain forms is also the result of a single base pair change in DNA resulting in an abnormal protein that is formed. This abnormal protein then forms deposits in the brain, specifically in the area called the hippocampus, which is the area of your brain responsible for memory. And those gobs of this protein, we call them plaques, interfere with nerve communication in that region. And so now we know that in some cases of Alzheimer's disease, the defect is simply a lousy protein that's made, a non-normal protein, abnormal protein. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean we can cure Alzheimer's, but it certainly helps us in identifying approaches to Alzheimer's disease. And there are, and we'll get to in a minute, the kinds of gene therapies that are possible for Alzheimer's and for some other things. One of the most fascinating examples of this kind of defect also occurs in bladder carcinoma, a particular form of cancer of the urinary bladder that is associated typically with a virus called the Epstein-Barr virus. And people could never understand. I mean, in the early days of the study of cancer, it was understood that cancer was wildly dividing cells that had somehow been triggered into this state. But there was no understanding whatsoever of what the trigger mechanism might be. And then an amazing thing was discovered shortly after the discovery of the tools of genetic engineering in the mid-70s, and that was that many cancers are associated with virus-like pieces of DNA that have been stuck into the chromosome of the cancerous cell. In other words, one model then is that a cancer is actually, in one particular form, or some particular forms of cancer, cancer may in fact be triggered by the injection into your gene coding system of viral genetic material. The virus infects you, inserts its DNA into your DNA, and that then triggers this kind of response. In the particular case that I'm talking about, in urinary bladder carcinoma, there was a very important thing that was found, and that is that just the infection by the virus did not cause the cancer. The virus, once it was in you, had to undergo another mutation, a subsequent mutation, a change in a single base pair of DNA. And if you changed one base pair of DNA in this viral region of the genome, you got cancer, bladder cancer. So again, what we're saying here is that without the tools of genetic engineering, you would never know what the defect is, because those are the only tools that allow us to see down to that fine detail level. And now we are able to identify defects in many diseases. Another way in which genetic engineering has been utilized is in the identification of things that cause disease. We call them pathogens. Things like viruses, for example, or bacteria that cause disease. Without the tools of genetic engineering, we would never know at this point in time what caused AIDS. But with the tools of genetic engineering, we now have a picture of the AIDS virus that is extremely detailed. Here's an AIDS virus. The AIDS virus is composed of two major types of molecules, proteins and RNA. Okay. The RNA is the genetic material. That's the thing that really is important, in the sense that that is what causes the problems once it infects you, because that little strand of RNA that's in there tells your cells to do some oddball things. And those oddball things end up killing you. Okay. The rest of these are protein molecules of one type or another. All these other dots and circles and colors and things, those are all the product of a specific gene. Okay, for example, this particular thing on the outside of the AIDS virus is called GP120. It stands for glycoprotein 120. GP120 is just a protein molecule that's has a weight of 120,000 kilodaltons, which means it's a pretty decent sized protein molecule, and it's made by one gene. Okay. I'm just saying that to differentiate it from GP41, which has a weight of 41,000 kilodaltons. They just name these things on the basis of how big they are. So that's the only significance of the letters and numbers and that kind of stuff.
And you can't see anything with the naked eye, can you?
You cannot. Oh, no, you can't see this with the naked eye. You can't even see it with a microscope.
Is it a big electron microscope?
Yeah, you can see these with an electron microscope, but you can't see the, you cannot see these individual molecules with an electron microscope, except the outer ones in some kind of fuzzy detail, even with the most powerful electron microscopes, and those are magnifying at 200,000 power. Okay, so we're talking about very tiny things here, very tiny. Okay, so when we're giving you a model like this, that model is based on our knowledge of the shape of proteins and the shape of RNA that is usually generated from a science called X-ray crystallography. And what you do there, it's sort of like a microscope, but what we do there, because the molecules are so small, we shoot X-rays at them and allow them to bounce off of the atoms that make up the molecules, and then we take pictures of where the X-rays bounce, and by knowing where the X-rays are not found, we can determine where the atom is, because it sort of prevents, it's sort of like forms a shadow then on the screen behind it. Very complex science, and but that's how you know what the structure of it is. Okay, understand things don't really look like this, basically. I mean, the AIDS virus is spherical, and it is covered with these things on the outside, there may be some resemblance to this on the inside, but these are all pictorial representations, and what we're really interested in is how they work. Okay. Yes?
Is that true of DNA too? That no one's ever seen DNA?
Yes, that's true. No one has ever seen DNA, but we can take the DNA molecule and coat it with gold atoms, okay, and make it very thick. As a result, sort of like mascara, if you will, you know, that's what the eyelashes, they just keep layering it on until they get thick enough so you can actually see them. If you want an actual visual picture of what DNA is, that's how we do it. We layer it with gold or other heavy metals, and then we do the same thing we did before, which is we shoot things at it like electrons. You can take a DNA molecule and coat it with gold and shoot electrons through it and see it in an electron microscope, and it looks like the picture of it we have, but we're actually not seeing the DNA molecule, we're seeing it coated.
But that's how you know it's a double helix, everything.
Well, no, we know the double helix from X-ray crystallography, in which we took the actual DNA, well, I didn't do it, but it was done in the 50s, in fact, it was done by a woman at Cambridge. She took the DNA molecule, and she never got enough credit for it, by the way, but she took the DNA molecule and shot X-rays at it, and she got this shadow that was characteristic of a double helix. She knew from the picture, from other things that she had worked with, that that's the kind of shadow you would expect. And in those days, what they did was they actually hand-built models at a macroscopic level so you could see them with your naked eye, and they shot light at it or did things like that and saw what happened. And then they would take these microscopic things and shoot things, and you know. So anyway, that's how they found out what DNA looked like.
I don't understand. I mean, this is a little bit revolving on me, but is this whole, just as a general sort of question, is this whole area of genetic engineering come about or taken its biggest jump with the discovery of DNA, or is that?
Well, the discovery of DNA was a necessary first step, but that happened. The discovery that DNA was in fact the genetic material was made already back in 1928. It began to be understood in 1928. In fact, an Oregonian had proposed the opposite, which was that proteins were the genetic material. His name was Linus Pauling. You may have heard of him. He's a living person that has 2 Nobel Prizes under his belt. He's still working at Cal Berkeley or someplace down there in California, and he comes up to Oregon for his vacations. He's about 92 or something. But his theory was that proteins were the only thing that were complex enough to give us the genetic material that we need to explain why everybody looks so different from each other. Okay. But in 1928, E. Frederick Griffiths did an experiment in which he took killed bacteria that were capable of causing pneumonia in mice when they were alive, but not capable of causing pneumonia in mice when they were killed. Okay. And he mixed them, these dead cells, he mixed with cells that were like them, but incapable of causing disease, but they were alive. And what happened is, when he did that, the mice died. Okay. So what was happening is some factor out of the bacteria that had been killed was transforming the living bacteria into killer bacteria. And then in 1942, Hershey and Chase identified that material as DNA. And then in 1953, Watson and Crick identified the structure of DNA as a double helix based on the work on X-ray crystallography work that had been done. Okay.
Why is genetic engineering all of a sudden taking off now?
That occurred in 1976. From 53 to 76, there was essentially no progress made in the understanding of DNA, or very little progress made in the understanding of DNA, because scientists recognized that DNA molecules were so huge that there was no way you could figure out what they looked like. The molecule itself is so long, you know, the rungs in its ladder number in the hundreds of millions, okay? And to be able, you see, back up a step. Proteins are much smaller in terms of their overall length. A typical protein has about 150 to 200 amino acid building blocks in a row. Okay. And so what they did in the 50s and 60s, they developed ways of finding out what the protein was made of. They just simply, with chemicals, clipped off each amino acid one at a time and found out what it was. And so they could determine the structure of protein just by doing that. So that's one thing, to chop off 150 or 200 of these things. But to sit there and think about 10 million, you know, in a row is like hopeless. And so they threw up their hands and said, we'll never know what DNA is really like. So really there was no hope. Then in 76, they discovered things called restriction enzymes, which cut DNA at specific spots. Only when you had certain letters in the DNA could this enzyme cut it. Okay. Well, that gave us a tool that we could at least break it down into smaller chunks. And then, sort of unknowingly, the people who discovered restriction enzymes that could cut it recognized that, sort of serendipitously recognized that the same thing allowed them to mix and match. You could take DNA out of one organism and stick it, therefore, into another organism. And then all of a sudden, you could get gobs of DNA made overnight in bacteria, like human DNA made overnight in bacteria, which gave you a lot of stuff to work with. Mm-hmm. And then since you could cut it into small chunks, now you could begin to look at each chunk, and then by overlapping the chunks, you could tell what the whole sequence of DNA is. In fact, that process is what's going on. Is what's going on right now. Oh, here. In the Human Genome Project, which is underway worldwide, in which we're attempting to determine the basis, the base sequence of DNA in the entire human genome. When that project is finished, to give you an idea of what we're talking about here, when that project is finished, we will have 500 volumes the size of a telephone book. Each of the volumes having 1,000 pages, each page having 2,000 letters on it, A, C, G, T, in sequence. Okay. So it's estimated that there will be a time delay here of 8 to 10 years just to get that basic information. but there are lots of labs working on it in conjunction with each other. It's a coordinated effort. And it's not even as simple as I'm making it out to be, because sequencing the DNA is a time-consuming process. Fortunately, now we've invented machines to do the work. When I was in graduate school, I did the work sequencing DNA, and you could get about 300 to 400 base pairs in about 3 days' work. Okay, and if you look at the human genome, we're talking about totally probably 30 billion base pairs. So it would have taken me about 2,522 years to finish that project doing it the old way. But they now have automatic sequencing machines that do the same thing that took me 3 days. They do it in about 2.5 hours. Okay, so it's much more rapid and much more routine, and therefore it's possible. Okay? Any other questions? I know this is difficult to understand. I'll tell you, the difficulty is that we are visual learners, most of us, visual thinkers, and we like to see stuff, you know, and if you can't actually see it with your eyes, you have trouble believing it's there, you know. And so when we talk about cutting DNA, a lot of people think, well, there's these scissors, they, you know, or they think that these scientists sitting in a lab with a very powerful microscope and they're taking razor blades and cutting stuff like that. But we never see what we cut. See, we never see it. It's all done in a test tube, and you just take the DNA that you want to cut, you purify it, throw it in the test tube, and take the cutting enzyme, which is our molecular scissor, if you will, throw it into the tube, and it cuts it. We know it cuts it because we can take the DNA and put it into a thin slice of jello-like material, and stick it underwater and put an electric current through the jello. And DNA is very negatively charged, it has a negative charge on it, so it'll go to the positive end of the thing. And since the small pieces of DNA travel faster than the big pieces of DNA, we can separate them out on the basis of size. And then we can see those, but then what you're dealing with, instead of one molecule of DNA, you're actually dealing with millions of copies of the DNA. And you just throw in a little stain that sticks to the DNA, and you throw on some ultraviolet light, and it fluoresces. So you can see where the DNA is, and you get these nice bands on your jello. So that's how you know that it actually is being cut. Okay, now, so we had AIDS. So the second thing is identification of pathogens. AIDS is one of them. The E. coli outbreak in Seattle Jack-in-the-Box restaurants recently. The only reason that was identified as rapidly as it was because they had genetically engineered molecular markers, sort of like little flags that they could throw onto the E. coli to find out which type of E. coli it really was. The old system in microbiology, the study of bacteria, was to throw it on a little dish with special food and see what it did. And then you try to identify which strain it was on that basis. And if any of you have ever taken microbiology, you know that that's a really touchy thing, because you know they don't like the particular food that you're growing them on or whatever. So the stuff was not reliable in many cases. So those kinds of advances are very helpful. Third thing that we do now in genetic engineering to help alleviate disease is the production of missing products. Okay, one of the things that cause disease is what we said are metabolic disorders, where something in your body is missing, an enzyme is missing, or an amino acid is missing, or something like that. So genetically, we can produce the product that's missing and therefore cure the disease. The most famous and the first of the products made by genetic engineering was genetically engineered insulin for diabetes, and that now is widely used, and it substitutes for animal-based insulin. The second one produced was growth hormone, and we talked about that the other day. And interestingly, I just picked up the New York Times in here yesterday night. I was bored and I was reading the New York Times, and one of the articles concerns a case being brought in France now, a a doctor in France is being charged with manslaughter. The reason he's being charged... is he treated pituitary dwarfism with ground-up pituitary glands that he bought from hospital orderlies who happened to be getting them from cadavers, dead people, and a large percentage of these dead people had Jakob Creutzfeldt disease, which is a disease somewhat similar to Alzheimer's in affecting the neurological function of the brain and causing death ultimately. And it's caused by a particle, a viral particle, that in fact is transmitted when the pituitary is ground up and used for growth hormone. And so these pituitary dwarfs were growing and then dying 2.5 years later from Jakob Creutzfeldt disease. And he apparently had been told by Luc Montagne. Luc Montagne is famous because he is the person who first identified the AIDS virus, and he works in, he's a French researcher, and he had written a letter in 1980 telling these doctors that were doing this growth hormone experiment not to use pituitaries, or to be very careful about using pituitaries from people with Jakob Creutzfeldt disease. And the guy was ignoring it because he could get the pituitaries for $8 a piece from the orderlies, and it was cheap. So anyway. Since that, you see, now here's the benefit of genetic engineering. What genetic engineering does is it allows you to produce growth hormone outside of the human body. So it's absolutely pure growth hormone. There's nothing else there. So when you inject it, there's no possibility that you could be giving a virus or some other kind of disease to the individual. As a result, development of biologically engineered growth hormone occurred in 1984, and clinical applications occurred in 1985 already. Since 1985, in France, they've used only genetically engineered growth hormone. And since 1985, then, no new cases of Jakob Creutzfeldt disease have occurred in pituitary dwarfs treated with growth hormone. So genetic engineering can give you that kind of product that therefore is better than anything else you can get from another source. A fourth way in which genetic engineering can be used in a disease is to produce things that inhibit or stop the disease-causing process from occurring. One of the situations that has increased in particularly the United States is the incidence of atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries, and therefore resulting in coronary disease. And one of the common treatments for this is a form of angioplasty in which you insert a sort of tube into the coronary artery, the artery that feeds the heart with blood, and at the spot of the blockage, you just sort of do a little scraping and sort of expand out the artery walls, and therefore the blood flow is increased. And then, of course, the next step is, if that doesn't work, you do coronary bypass surgery, in which you take a portion of the femoral artery or something like that and stick it up there and replace the original coronary artery. Both of those are very dangerous procedures. And angioplasty has the problem that the original site of the angioplasty often is infiltrated by smooth muscle cells once the angioplasty has been done. And these smooth muscle cells proceed to block the artery once again anyway. So in relatively short order, the angioplasty is ineffective and people get clogged arteries again. What we can do now, and what has been already tried in rat models that have hardening of the arteries or atherosclerosis, is to inject genetically engineered platelet-derived growth factor, which is a hormone that inhibits the growth of smooth muscle cells and inhibits their movement into that scraped out area. So therefore, recurrences of the blockage don't occur. So we have a direct application there to heart disease. In the case of the AIDS virus, let me show you a little story about AIDS, because AIDS is such a humongous problem in the world. I'd like to get into that totally, but we don't have enough time for that. But basically, in order to understand something about AIDS, you have to understand something about the immune system. And I'll just give you a real quick primer on how the immune system works. Okay. This is a cartoon depiction. This is the skin, and you're getting punctured by something, okay, like a knife blade or a piece of glass or something like that. And so you have something that enters you, like a bacteria or a foreign particle, or it could be that you don't actually puncture the skin. It could be that it just irritates the skin, like pollen grains do sometimes. And that's why you get these allergic reactions and sneezing and wheezing and all that stuff. Anyway, here's what happens when the antigen, whatever it is, whether it's a bacteria or a foreign piece of protein or something else, gets into your blood. First of all, it's attacked by white blood cells. The particular type that attacks this stuff is called macrophage, which literally means a big eater. Okay. And it does. It just eats this thing. That's what it does. It eats it, and then it chops it up. And then you'll notice that they've sort of represented this antigen with these little spiky things on it. And so when the macrophage eats it, it displays those on its outer surface. Okay. And now the other thing that happens is there are in your body already at birth about maybe 2 million different kinds of B lymphocytes, B cells. They're also white blood cells. But these are the ones that ultimately will produce antibodies in your blood that fight off these infections or fight off whatever it is you want to fight off, like the pollen grain and stuff. Okay. So when these antigens come up into the cell, they also attach to a specific cell surface protein molecule called a receptor. Think of it as an antenna, like you have a TV antenna on the roof of your house. Okay, this is a signal that's picked up by the antenna. And this antenna is specifically designed so it will only bind, out of 2 million B cells, only one will bind to this particular antigen. The others will not, because they're not specifically designed. They don't have a specific receptor for that molecule. Okay? Then, this macrophage, and this is the last important step in this process, this macrophage has to specifically bind to a cell called a T helper cell, or T lymphocyte, okay, which is another type of white blood cell. And when it does, these two things together stimulate this B cell to divide and make copies of itself. And so now, instead of having one B cell, you end up with millions of B cells, all producing this antibody, which was at one time the receptor on the surface of the cell. Okay, and that stuff flows around in your bloodstream, and anytime this antigen then enters your bloodstream later, those antibodies attack it. Okay, and they are a molecular glue that allows these antigens actually to stick to each other. So you get big globs of antigens. And when the macrophages find those big globs of antigens, they come along and eat them. And so you get rid of any bacteria in your body. And in fact, that's in large part, that's what happens anytime you get a wound or any kind of foreign body enters your bloodstream. That's what happens. Okay. So, and then you get some of these B cells that stay around as B memory cells. They're in your blood, so you have a larger pool then of cells, so that the next time you get infected, you remember that you've been infected before, and you can produce the antibody very rapidly, which is the whole idea behind vaccines. What vaccines do is trigger an antigenic response right away. You get a small amount of response because they usually use a killed virus or some kind of mild agent, small quantities of it. But you form a lot of B memory cells as a result,
Then a little later, they give you a booster shot, which is more antigen, and that gives you more B memory cells. So then when you do get the real thing, the virulent strain of measles or whooping cough or whatever, then you've got all these B memory cells in your bloodstream and you can respond to it immediately. Because this process from beginning of infection to here takes maybe sometimes 4 days, sometimes a week, sometimes 12 days. Well, in some cases, if that happens, you're too late because the disease-causing organism has already killed you. You don't have enough time to respond to it with your immune system. All right, so what does AIDS do and why is AIDS such a nasty thing? Okay. Well, AIDS has this effect. Same thing. Skin is punctured, this time with AIDS viruses. Typically, this happens during sexual intercourse or drug use or when hemophiliacs receive blood transfusions that have the HIV virus in them. Okay? And forget about this right now. But what happens in the AIDS case is that, remember the T4 helper cells that triggered the B cell to divide? Those T4 helper cells get infected by the AIDS virus and get killed. So we have no T4 helper cells around. So you can't stimulate the B cells to produce antibodies to anything. Therefore, when you get infected with a pneumonia bacteria, for example, or virus that causes pneumonia, either one, you don't have any way of fighting it. So what do you hear people dying from? They don't die from AIDS. They die from pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, a particular type of pneumonia that is typically only found in people with depressed immune systems, like very old people, or people who have been sick for other reasons. You see them dying. AIDS patients die also from Kaposi's sarcoma. That's a cancer. Why? Well, because your immune system also fights cancer cells. It recognizes cancer cells as different from normal cells and attacks those cells and fights them. Well, in AIDS patients, you have no cancer-fighting immune system anymore. Okay. So now, knowing this, one of the things that we can use as a therapy and one of the approaches that's being used is the fact that in order to infect the T4 cell, the AIDS virus has to find a specific receptor protein on the surface of the T4 cell, okay, and bind to it. In other words, the AIDS virus doesn't just lop onto any T4 cell and stick to it. The T4 cell actually has a receptor for the, remember that GP120, the outer protein, the big protein on the outside of the AIDS virus that I showed you before? That thing has a specific keyhole, if you will, into which it must fit on the surface of the T4 cell. So one therapy for AIDS is to produce something that looks like GP120, only doesn't have anything else attached to it. The rest of the AIDS virus is missing. And throw it into the bloodstream of the person that's attacked by the AIDS virus and block all these binding sites so that the AIDS virus can no longer bind to the T4 cell. Okay, that's one kind of approach to the particular disease of AIDS. Unfortunately, despite all this knowledge and understanding and all that stuff, the situation with AIDS is currently dismal. None of these therapies have worked. None of the drugs like AZT are effective virtually at all. The most recent studies, I just again read yesterday that they had, in February of this year, they had an announcement in Nature magazine that they were going to use a triple drug therapy, three different drugs, AZT, two other drugs that I forget what they were right now. Anyway, three drug therapy for AIDS, and they had done it in clinical trials, and it was supposedly very effective in controlling the AIDS virus. And they just came out yesterday and said that the original study was flawed and that there is no hope with that type of therapy at all. So the current status with AIDS is we don't have a clue what to do. None. We are no further along in, well, I won't say that. We have not found any vaccines nor any effective treatment for AIDS. And the current state is that if you get AIDS, you die. It's that simple. There are, I think, a total of 7 people
that have been documented to survive over 12 years. And there have been, in the United States alone, now over 200,000 deaths from AIDS. So it's a very tragic situation as far as that particular disease is concerned. It's tragic in America. It's much more tragic in Central Africa, where in some cases up to 50% of the population of males between the age of 18 and 35 is currently infected with the AIDS virus, which means they will all die in the next 10 years. Now think about that. If that would happen in America, 50% of our workforce, the male workforce, were to die in the next 10 years, what that would do to our health system, what that would do to our economic system. And these countries are, of course, third world countries to begin with, so they don't have a lot to spare. Yes?
How many people with the HIV virus contract actually get AIDS?
I'm going to be a little guarded in my response, but basically the bottom line is everybody.
Really?
There are some cases of people that have been documented who, for some unknown reason, have had the AIDS virus in them, apparently, and have not gone on to full-blown AIDS, have not progressed to the disease. You have to understand there's two different things. Yeah. We're talking about the infection, right, which doesn't necessarily correlate with the disease, but always progresses to the disease later. Okay, in 99.99% of the cases, that's true. There are some exceptions, and they're being intensively studied to see why the virus has not gone on to cause the AIDS. And it's just such a complex question, and there are so few examples that it's very difficult to
say. If you're HIV positive, then you basically, it's a matter of time before you're going to get that.
That's right. That's kind of a bleak outlook, and I'm not trying to, if anybody here happens to be HIV positive, I'm not trying to spell doom and disaster for you. I'm trying to get across the reality of the disease as we know it today is ranks among the most devastating diseases we've ever faced on the face of the earth. Really, it's nasty.
Can life be prolonged by living in a bubble, avoiding infection?
Yes, to a certain extent that may be possible, although some of the diseases like Kaposi sarcoma are probably not necessarily environmentally induced at that particular stage in life. They may have already been triggered earlier in life, but before AIDS they were suppressed by the immune system, and then once AIDS comes along the suppression is gone and so the cancer takes over. It's possible, but boy, of course, that's a very bleak existence too. You know, I'm not sure if I had AIDS, I'd like to live in a bubble. You know, I don't know. It's something I have to decide at that point.
Are they able to detect this virus in blood prior to somebody's transfusion?
Yes, they are. Okay, we have a series of different tests now that are very effective in identifying the antigens from the AIDS virus in blood of people who have been exposed to it. The problem, there is one problem with that, and that is that the current situation is that those detection kits work basically on people who were exposed 3 months or more earlier to the disease. And so there's this lag gap, which is one of the reasons that various practices have been instituted in blood banks and things to prevent that type of contamination from occurring. But there's never any totally foolproof method of doing things like this in life. I mean, there are always mistakes going to be made. But the situation today is much better than it was, you know, 10 years ago when there was no testing for HIV at all in blood banks. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I don't want to take you too far afield here, but you know, one thing that's never been satisfactorily explained to me is we still have this case, unless I'm misinformed, about the dentist.
Uh-huh.
He's transmitting it to patients.
Right.
And you've got the Centers for Disease Control saying it's not transmitted that way. I've got a feeling there's a lot
No, that's not true. It's in the case of the dentist, there was a direct connection between his blood contaminating their blood during the dental procedures.
Oh,
okay.
I
so,
that's, in this particular case, I think the number now is 6 patients have been infected from that one.
So there was blood contact, but they're still, they're still saying that it can't be done by saliva or other things, aren't they?
Right. And that's, the reason for that is the number of cases where you have AIDS in a family situation in which other members of the family share glasses and have for years, and there's been no effect at all on that. And there is, I mean, the AIDS virus is a very interesting thing in terms of how it's transmitted. I have some theories about that. For example, and this is going to rankle some feathers in the medical community, but my belief is that it's difficult to transmit AIDS between healthy heterosexual people. Okay, I mean, if one partner has AIDS, but it's not in the full-blown AIDS stage, but the other partner does not, I think it's quite difficult if you're dealing with normal vaginal intercourse. I believe a number of things are contributing to the incidence of AIDS in the homosexual population. One of them is the use of anal intercourse. Okay. And there's the other factor is that AIDS is very prevalent in prostitution, in cases involving prostitutes. And I believe that's because prostitutes quite frequently have other sexually transmitted diseases which have compromised the membranes of their reproductive tract. And so there's already wounds present and direct access to the blood system because of it. In the case of anal intercourse, the anus simply was not designed as a receptacle for intercourse and is a very different membrane from the vagina. The vagina is thick and it's lubricated. The anal membrane is thin, non-lubricated, and is very easily shred. So the anal intercourse almost always involves some measure of compromise of the membranes of the anus. And if you have something like syphilis or gonorrhea, you also have a compromise of the membranes of the vagina in that particular case, or can have. And that, I believe, is a contributing factor to the prevalence of the disease in those two populations. You find this in the cases in Africa, where you have this large or preponderance of cases in the heterosexual community. Number one, there is not as large a proportion of homosexual activity in these countries as there is in America. But what the theory here is that what happened about 20 years ago is you had this migration of individuals from rural districts to the urban areas and a huge increase in prostitution. And that allowed the AIDS virus to just go rampantly through the population, which it did. So you have, I believe the forecasts that AIDS will run roughshod through the heterosexual population of America are wrong. I don't think it will. I don't think it will. It's certainly going to increase some from where it is now, but the predictions were always that it would go off like exponentially, and just really take off. And the fact is, it hasn't. Still, I think in America today, of the cases that have been documented, only about 4 to 6% are within the heterosexual population. Can be documented to not have had a transfusion or have had intravenous drug use.
Well, the Bible's been right all along, because the Lord just didn't say it from sort of abstract principle, and the biblical going way back didn't say avoid promiscuous behavior just because, some abstract form, that's a good thing. I mean, it had much more to do with that. There's always much more knowledge there than even most people are willing to accept. But so you just don't engage in promiscuous sexual activity, because the more you engage in it, the more likely you are to go afield from normal heterosexual relations into other avenues of sexuality that aren't healthy.
Right.
Could kill you.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it's so lethal, though, would you advocate premarital testing for HIV virus?
Well, the area of testing is really a hot potato, as you may know. depends on.
Use glycerin, you know, for sure.
Sure.
Yeah, right. I don't understand this either.
It is a politically incorrect concept. Okay. And my sense is they certainly should have the opportunity to do that. I think, you know, and they do currently have that opportunity, but I think they should be counseled in that direction. I may be a little resistant to forcing people to do it, but on the other hand, I don't understand totally the rejection of that notion. I think there's a new wave of thinking in America that says, you know, the state has no right to interfere in private lives at all in any kind of way, shape, or form, which is patently absurd because we do it all the time in various ways.
Yeah,
we pay taxes.
We don't let kids get into school without certain.
Right, exactly. Yeah, but AIDS is it's politically sensitive because of the potential for discrimination, because it is so prevalent in the homosexual community. Still today in America, 76 or 77% of all AIDS patients are homosexual males. So it's still by far the majority.
Well, syphilis, which we test, you know, is treatable, but
right.
You know, the HIV. Yeah. It seems to be the grounds are stronger for HIV testing than for glycerin.
Right, but it is a politically unpopular notion now because of political action committees that are very strong.
If it gets so bad, though, the politics will change because people are going to demand it. I mean, this is what I think that, you know.
That's true. People's ethics change directly with economics. We mentioned that the other day.
Is there any hint that it'll be reclassified from a disability to a disease? I mean, it is a disease. It is now classified as a disability.
Yeah, right.
Now, for instance, you can't be refused medical treatment because of AIDS, because of disability. It's not a disease.
I'm not sure what the politics are going to be on that.
And back on David Acer, the dentist in Florida, there is some evidence, it's not without a doubt yet, but there's some evidence that he did it on purpose.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that. I think the chances of it occurring simply, spontaneously or randomly are very minimal, especially with a large number of victims.
Yeah, he was just fed up with the fact that there wasn't enough research going on. He said the only way to call attention to it is to have some old people and some young people die from it.
Yeah.
And so he just did it on purpose.
That's one possibility, I think.
So six, seven, eight counts of murder.
Let me, we only have a few more. In fact, we're over time, I guess. Huh? I just want to mention another form of genetic therapy that's even more exciting, I think, than anything we've mentioned so far, and that is the ability to directly transfer genes for good stuff into cells that are bad. And the classic example of this that's the hot topic right now is cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is one of the most common genetic defects among Americans. One out of every 2,500 live births has cystic fibrosis. So it's a very common disease, and it has its effect by because a gene in the cells of the lungs does not do its job in transporting an ion across the cell membrane, okay, in this case the sodium ion, which is a part of salt. And as a result, the lung tissue itself doesn't have enough fluid on the outside. It's sort of like the idea of salting meat. If you put salt on meat, you preserve it because the water is sucked out of the meat. Okay, what happens in the case of cystic fibrosis is the water is sucked out off the surface of the cells of the lung. As a result, what is normally very liquidy phlegm over the surface of your lungs, which you have over the surface all the time, becomes very coagulated and thick and mucousy. And so people with cystic fibrosis have a very difficult time breathing. And if you have a friend or relative with cystic fibrosis, the treatment is actually simply to slap them on the back about 6 or 7 times a day to loosen up the phlegm so that they can breathe more easily. It's not a very effective treatment, obviously, and it also is potentially fatal later in development. Exciting stuff is happening right now, and that is the insertion of a good gene for that sodium pump into a rhinovirus
which causes the common cold, and it normally infects, this virus normally infects the lining of the lung. But they've genetically engineered the virus so they can't cause a cold, but it can still infect the cells of the lungs. And they've inserted into that virus this good gene for the cystic fibrosis product. And they've done trials now in rats where they simply take this genetically engineered virus in a water-based solution and put it in an atom.